各位观众朋友，大家好，欢迎收看《美国观察》，我是林森。首先来关注今天的重要新闻。好，新闻头条，我们来关注的是美国国防部长奥斯汀6月14日抵达布鲁塞尔，主持乌克兰防务联络小组会议，讨论援助乌克兰抵抗俄罗斯侵略的下一步行动。国防部表示，有多达50个国家参加这次会议，讨论的焦点为顿巴斯地区的战况。据分析，如果俄罗斯在顿巴斯获胜，意味着乌克兰不仅损失了土地，战斗能力也遭受严重的损失，使得俄罗斯能够夺取更多的土地，并向乌克兰提出条件。俄罗斯失败则为乌克兰反攻打下基础，有可能会引发克里姆林宫的内乱。一名乌克兰官员说，俄罗斯军队已经攻入了乌东城市北顿涅茨克的中心，并继续炮击有数以百计居民栖身的一座化工厂。卢甘斯克州州长谢尔盖·海达伊6月13日说，俄军控制了北顿涅茨克的70%，并把乌军逼出了市中心。他说，北顿涅茨克的亚速特化工厂正遭到猛烈的炮击，有数百名平民在这里栖身。海达伊说，大约有500名平民仍然留在化工厂，乌军正试图把他们转移到安全地带。俄罗斯说，所有通往城市的桥梁都被摧毁。乌克兰官员说，仍然有一条出城的道路，但是这条线路严重的破损。乌克兰总统泽连斯基说，顿巴斯战役肯定会成为军事史上欧洲最惨烈的战役之一。美国国务院6月14日宣布，美国与加拿大以及其他的盟友建立了一项新的伙伴关系，旨在确保在全球对稀土和锂等关键的矿物需求不断上涨之际，确保这些矿物的供应链的安全。白宫说，这些关键矿物包括稀土、锂和钴，它们是清洁能源技术的关键材料。美国国务院说，矿物安全合作伙伴关系旨在帮助加快来自政府和私营部门的投资用于战略投资的机会。美国政府一直在与加拿大合作，以加强地区供应链，抗衡中国在这个产业的垄断。参与这项矿物安全合作伙伴关系包括澳大利亚、加拿大、芬兰、法国、德国、日本、韩国、瑞典、英国、美国和欧盟委员会。另一方面，美国国防部与澳大利亚的亚莱纳斯稀土公司签署了一项在美国建稀土加工厂的协议，以减少对这些矿物的主要生产国中国的依赖。白宫表示，目前对中国实施的关税有些并未能促进美国的利益，反而给美国的家庭和企业造成了负担。目前正在讨论如何调整对中国的关税政策，使其有利于美国的劳工和企业，并且促进美国的国家安全。详细情况来看美国之音白宫记者黄耀毅的报道。
拜登总统星期三前往宾州费城会见工会领袖，并且针对美国的经济发表讲话。阿斯有新闻在星期二的时候报道说呢，在上个星期与椭圆形办公室当中，拜登总统与他的内阁成员进行会议时，表示倾向移除某些在特朗普时期的中国关税。那么在飞往费城的空军一号上呢，白宫发言人尚皮耶针对相关报道做出回应。
We have said from the beginning, some Trump tariffs were irresponsible, and do not advance our economic or national security, and instead raise costs for families and businesses. And I've said many times that, you know, we're discussing this and working to align, these haphazard tariffs and our priorities to safeguard the interests of our workers in critical industries, boosting American workers' wages and creating jobs, securing the resilience of our supply chain, sustaining our technology edge, and advancing our national security. I don't have anything to share about what the president's decision is at this time. As you know, this is something that we're discussing internally. I don't have anything new.
拜登总统在针对工会的演说当中表示，他的政府正在极力对抗通货膨胀，那么也在对抗由于普京入侵乌克兰所带来的油价上涨，包括大力的推动可再生能源，让美国未来就不需要再依赖恶霸强权来进口能源。此外呢，他也强调美国并不是由华尔街所建造的，美国是由广大的美国劳工支撑，而工会创造了中产阶级。他就誓言保障美国普罗大众的福祉，包括要保护社会安全金还有健康保险等等。美国之音白宫记者黄毅白宫报道。
另一方面，台湾外交部6月14日表示，台湾海峡是国际水域，适用于国际法公海自由的原则，台湾也理解并且支持美国在台海自由航行的任务，对促进地区和平的稳定带来的注意。台湾外交部的声明被视为针锋相对的驳斥和反击北京外交部前一天有关国际海洋法上并无国际水域一说，以及中国对台海享有主权和管辖权的说法。台湾外交部发言人欧江安在星期二的例行记者会上说，台湾海峡是国际水域，属于中华民国台湾领海范围以外的水域，均适用国际法的公海自由原则。美国国防部发言人马丁梅纳斯日前表示，美国将继续在国际法允许的地方飞越、航行和运作，而这也包括穿越台湾海峡。美国国会参众两院两大政党的一些议员共同推出了一项规管海外投资的法律草案，以确保美国关键的工业生产能力不会流失给中国。这些议员6月13日发表了一份联合声明，宣布就美国海外投资政策达成了立法共识，并将其纳入庞大的跨党派创新与竞争法的两党两院协商程序。联合声明说，建立海外投资审查机制是国会努力确保美国重要行业供应链不被中国等问题国家控制的一项关键措施。据信，拜登政府原则上支持这项立法背后的精神。根据这项草案，美国公司在向海外输送对国家经济和安全至关重要的工业技术和生产能力之前，必须事先向联邦政府部门报告。政府可以运用现有的授权禁止相关的海外投资，或者要求公司采取降低风险的措施。中共在网络上审查追踪，并以入狱酷刑等手段压制意见。一位华人女律师代表受害者在美国发起诉讼，追究帮助中国公安建立网络防火墙的硅谷高科技公司的法律责任。纽约外百老汇话剧《金盾工程》的创作者将以真实的事件为依据，充满沉重的细节，混合中英文的素材，改编成节奏轻快的文化冲突剧。
So first of all, let's talk about yourself. What's your story? What's your background? And how did you get interested in theater?
I am half Thai and half Australian. And I've been doing theater, sort of like weird indie theater in Australia since I was really young. And I sort of tried everything. I was like a designer, mostly a sound designer, did some like acting and directing. And it wasn't until I came to grad school in New York that I got interested in writing for the theater. So, and then I kind of stumbled into being a playwright.
And how does your parents feel about this? Because, you know, in my experience, Asian parents are not very enthusiastic.
I think my mother was really worried about me being an artist when I was growing up as a kid, particularly about being a designer. She really wanted me to be a neurosurgeon. Of course, you know, because Asian parents. But I stubbornly rebelled and kept going down the artist track. And I think now that I'm comfortably making a living doing it, she's begrudgingly accepted it.
You proved to her that you can do it.
Yeah, I mean, for now.
What about, like, in your, as a playwright, right? Your colleagues, your fellow students, are there many Asians there?
I mean, yeah, one of the nice things about the kinds of plays that I write is that they usually center Asian characters. I'm really interested in, like, the politics of representation and making sure that we have more complex Asian characters in media. So a lot of my colleagues are Asian, Asian American. Like, for example, in Golden Shield, the role of the translator was kind of written for Fong because we went to grad school together. And I knew that he was this really extraordinary actor who could speak both Mandarin and English, and I was like, let's use him.
So let's talk about the play, right? Why Golden Shield? What made you interested in this topic?
I mean, like most of my plays, I was reading about it. I was reading about the real court cases that the play is based on, where Chinese plaintiffs sued American tech companies for their purported collusion with the Chinese government in helping to build the Great Firewall. And I thought it was such an interesting set of ethical conundrums that these cases raised. So then I just started doing an enormous amount of research into both the development of the Great Firewall in China and into how these cases got arbitrated.
And how is the American general public receiving it? Are they familiar with the topic?
You know, it's interesting. The play had a production in Australia before it had a production here, and I think Australian audiences were far more aware because of, you know, Australia's close relationship to China, of the issues in the play. I think American audiences actually, a lot of them had no idea that there is a sort of completely different internet in China. Unless you're sort of like reading a lot of global news, I think a lot of Americans are learning a lot from the play. But a lot of the play is about, you know, as American consumers, our complicity in supporting these companies that have helped to create these tools of oppression overseas. So it's not as simple as, you know, like China is oppressive, America is liberal and a democracy. The play sort of tries to complicate that. And I think American audiences are really engaging with that.
So for your audience, right, when they walk out of the theater after the play, what do you want them to know? What are you trying to tell them?
I think the message of the play ultimately is that, like, as fraught as communication is, communication between different cultures, communication over the internet, communication like between family members and loved ones, as impossible as it is, it's like necessary. It's like the only tool that we have. It's what makes us human. And I hope that people leave the play realizing that like the struggle to communicate is what makes us fundamentally human.
So you have different topics of the play, communications, loyalty, of course, censorship, and also the delicate art of translation. Yeah. Why?
I mean, because I knew I wanted to write about this story, which is a Sino-American story, I knew I wanted the play to be in both Mandarin and in English. And when I was trying to work out how to do that, I realized that there could be this central figure in the play who's just the translator, and he translates not just the literal languages, but like the subtext of the play, the paratext. And that really opened up the world of the play. It meant that I could talk about a huge amount of issues and never worry that I was going to lose the audience because they always have this, like, gentle guide to explain these really big issues to them.
Let's talk about your characters. I'm very interested in Julie and Eva. So before we talk about their relationships, can you tell us about what characters are they and why they're, like, who they are?
Sure. So Julie and Eva are like the sisters in the play. Julie is a lawyer arbitrating one of these cases, and Eva is her younger sister, and she hires her as her translator. And a lot of the play is about their complex relationship to being Chinese American, which is really tied up in this traumatic relationship that they had with their Chinese mother. And they've responded to that trauma in really different ways. Julie becomes this sort of like hard-nosed, emotionally unavailable lawyer with a lot of like suppressed rage, but a lot of drive and righteousness. And Eva becomes much more of a mediator. She becomes much more sort of calculated, and she views relationships as like very transactional. And I really wanted the play to explore like the tension between those two sisters and their desire to connect as a metaphor for the larger themes in the play about our desire to communicate even when it's such a fraught endeavor.
They're sisters, but Julie spent her whole adult life in America, and Eva spent a crucial time in China. How does that make them different?
Because Eva is the younger sibling and spent a lot more time in China than Julie, Eva has more cultural fluency moving between the two worlds and is actually, you know, fluent in Mandarin, which Julie is not. And that really informs her worldview. She's much more, she has a much more nuanced understanding of Chinese culture, whereas Julie's understanding of Chinese culture, there's a lot of, like, self-directed racism towards her own Chineseness, and that comes from her sense of alienation to her home culture. And I think that the relationship between the two of them is kind of stages a conflict I think anybody in the diaspora experiences where you, when you feel alienated from your home culture and trying to move between the two worlds.
So for this traumatic relationship between Julie and Eva, how much does their mother play?
It's a huge part of their relationship and is like the wound at the core of their relationship that means that they can't communicate effectively with each other. And the play sort of dances around exactly what that relationship was. You sort of get a sense that it was an extremely emotionally damaging environment and that their mother was kind of tyrannical. But just like they can't talk about it because it's like too much to talk about, the play doesn't really talk about it. And it, like, the play doesn't talk about their core traumas, it implies them. Like, there's this line where the translator goes, "We won't speak of the father because, of course, they never did." And I think that's also very true of Asian families.
Yeah. Not talking about it is very Asian.
Very Asian. Not talking about your core familial traumas, I think, is a deeply Asian experience.
Do you think the American public gets it?
I think everybody can relate to having stuff in your family that you don't talk about. And I think everybody can relate to, you know, how messy and complicated families are and this desire to stay bonded even when you're growing apart as people. I think that's universal. There are things about Eva and Julie's relationship that feels very specific to their Chinese-American heritage, but then there's also things about the dynamic that feel really universal to all families. So I think American audiences do take that away from it, even if they don't understand necessarily some of the nuances of their cultural experience.
I remember in one of the acts, right, Julie's boss, Richard, asked her that what is her drive to pursue the case? Mm. What is her drive?
I think he ultimately, well, that's the question of the play, actually, like, what is she actually driven by? And the play proposes a lot of different things that it could be, which I think is true of people who experience a lot of formative trauma. Sometimes they're driven by a sense of righteousness and they don't really know where it's coming from, and it's a corrective to the trauma that you've experienced as a kid. So Eva sort of thinks that Julie's drive is really about, like, getting revenge against her mother, and sort of she sees the Chinese government as a metaphor for her mother, basically, as, like, a totalitarian force that she has to, like, strive to defeat. Richard's has a more nuanced perspective on that. He thinks that it's just a sort of primal desire to win at any cost. And I think that that's true of a lot of lawyers, true of a lot of activists. The desire to win, politicians, the desire to win can sometimes muddy the intent that you set out with. You know, the desire to win kind of subsumes the moral system that you had gotten into that business to in the first place.
What about Max? What is his drive?
His drive is efficiency. And he's really, he really represents a sort of, in some ways, he's the most archetypal character in the play, because he is a software engineer, even though he ends up in management. He really represents this desire to, this utilitarian desire for efficiency at all cost. The tension in that character is that he sort of can't understand the moral reverberations of the decisions that he's making and the tools that he's giving the Ministry of Public Security.
And at any point did he feel that, oh, I might be doing something wrong?
Right at the end of the play. I mean, I think everybody at the end of the play has a real moment of crisis where they wonder about the moral relativism of what they're doing. And I really like that he remains sort of, like, doggedly unpleasant for almost the entire play, and then right at the end, he has a moment of being like, am I the bad guy? Which I think is very satisfying to watch as an audience.
Right. But I mean, for Max, right, for Marshall, mm-hmm. As a software engineer, seeking efficiency is not wrong.
Yeah.
But at what point should he take morality into consideration?
Yeah, and I think that's the question that everybody's having for these tech multinationals right now. It's like, if efficiency is your ultimate remit, and you wash your hands of any moral responsibility for the way that people use your hyper-efficient tools, who's responsible, you know? And that's the question.
What is your take on that?
Yeah, and I think that they are ultimately responsible. Of course, these, I think tech multinationals would like us to believe that the tools and the platforms that they create are neutral, are like morally neutral, and then the ways in which they're employed are what give them sort of negative connotations. But if you create a platform that enables censorship or sex trafficking, I think you are culpable. I think that, and I think you can't absolve yourself of that culpability just because it's a tool.
But for these corporates, right, private sectors, is it too much to ask them to be responsible for the users, the public?
I think, you know, that's a really nuanced question, and both things are true. I think, obviously, the criminal syndicates or the oppressive governments who are using these tools in nefarious ways are equally culpable, but I do think that there has to be more political oversight around these corporations, and there has to be more private culpability. And in China and America, it's two sides of the same coin. The internet is being used to shut down discourse in different ways. So I think that's what the play really wants to explore. It's not as simple as, big bad China oppressing its citizenry through shutting down discourse online and creating a domestic internet. It's look at the ways that in both countries the internet is being used to shut down communication.
And in the future, do you still want to write about Asian American?
That's a really complicated question for me. I obviously am extremely invested in making sure that there's more nuanced representation of Asian Americans, Asian Australians in Western media, because I think it's sorely lacking. But I also am very aware of being pigeonholed or subjectified by my own identity politics. So I would like to not feel restricted to only being able to tell Asian stories because I'm Asian. I am far more interested in telling stories about globalization and technology writ large on a macrocosmic scale. So whatever cultural form that takes, I don't want to police myself based on my own identity politics.
欢迎回来。美国枪支犯罪持续不断的情况下，其他各种刑事犯罪也在增加。在马萨诸塞州波士顿郊外的小城切尔西街上巡逻的警官何塞·罗德里戈茨和丹尼尔·阿提加身在第一线，明确地感受到这个城市的治安情况出现恶化，特别是在人们逐步恢复到疫情前的生活状态时，犯罪率也全面上升。这与新冠疫情大流行开始以来全美犯罪率上升的报道一致。
So I think Chelsea, in general, follows the stats of most bigger cities. Although we are small in size, land size, we have a lot of people in our city, and so I think it follows that. It's a very dense population, just like the rest of the country has seen an uptick in gun calls, things like that. So have we. I think in general, there has been more call volume. There's been more, you know, responding to more people, calls for service. I think there's just an increase in activity overall. I think there's more people outside doing things. I think there's more people going to gatherings. There's just overall a lot more activity.
Definitely crime is picking up. You know, we see it. Shootings, I think, well, I hope it doesn't happen, but I suspect this is going to be a very busy summer. Just the way it kind of, just at the start of the summer, just the way things have been going. Not just here, but in neighboring cities. You know, usually crime in one city leads over to our city and vice versa. So we're all expecting a very busy summer. Much more gun violence.
乌克兰面包投资公司自俄罗斯入侵以来就从未停止过生产面包，尽管在三月份战事紧迫期间，有的厂房距离前线只有几公里，面包的出产也不曾间断。然而炸弹摧毁了公司的一处厂房，让昔日的活跃繁忙的场所变成了一片世界末日的景象。今天工厂管理层正在寻找资金进行重建，然而他们不知冲突将持续多久，并担心获得所需建材和设备的机会会受到影响。
Работать во время войны было непросто. Было много проблем, трудностей, связанных и с людьми, и с поставками сырья, и с отгрузкой готовой продукции. Ну, не последнюю роль играли обстрелы, которые не прекращались, потому что наш завод расположен в непосредственной близости от линии боевых действий. Примерно около 5-7 километров до активных действий. И все это накладывало отпечаток на нашу работу.
Ну, я безпосередньо керував будівництвом цього заводу. І коли 17 березня цього року я приїхав і тут ще працювали пожежні машини, стояв дим, всередині ще все горіло. В мене просто були сльози на очах, в мене перехватило дихання, тому що бачити, як те, що ти створював практично своїми руками, знаходиться в такому стані, все горить, це просто не передати, це катастрофа у всіх відношеннях. Це...
Кожен небайдужий, чи то фізична особа, чи юридична, може допомогти не тільки нам, не тільки Чанті, а і іншим підприємствам харчової галузі України, які постраждали внаслідок Російської Федерації, обстрілу Російської Федерації.
Ну, проблемы с посевной уже есть, потому что много посевных площадей заминировано, много техники разрушено. Опять же, посевной материал, скорее всего, тоже уничтожен частично. Будут ли проблемы или нет, это покажет уже результаты посевной и как соберут урожай. Я надеюсь, что нет, не будет, потому что ну, Украина всегда была житницей Европы, и мы производили всегда зерна больше, чем потребляли, поэтому... Не должно бути. Ну, все буде залежати від розвитку бойових дій.
Ішан就是今天美国观察的全部内容。感谢您的收看，下次节目再见。